Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to give lecture in this school. So I would like to start the lecture with some overview of scattering amplitudes in quantum field theories. And I think my emphasis of most of the lecture will be on the more formal side. So basically, the lecture one and two will be just very basic stuff with color decomposition of Young mu's amplitude, and I'll tell you about relations among amplitudes in gauge theories and also in gravity. And then tomorrow I'll introduce spinor helicity just briefly so that we can discuss some very interesting formula in gluon scattering, like this so-called Park-Taylor formula, which will lead us to the second part of my plan, which is the remaining three lectures will be based on about a new formulation of all the scattering amplitudes of massless particles at tree level for the moment, with a new formulation that's based on this so-called Riemann spheres. So you will see about the so that's roughly the plan. So I may not look exactly the same as in the printed schedule. Okay, so let's get started. So basically, the first two will be very basic things, which is known 20 years ago, and some of them are known a long time ago. And the last three lectures will be more recent progresses, but it's all on the more formal side. So the object we'll be studying is the scattering amplitudes in quantum field theory, and we know that this is really like at the heart of high energy physics because scattering amplitudes, they connect theories with experiments. So on this side, we have quantum field theories, and on this side, we have, I would say, not only just experiments that you probably learn a lot also this week, but also some tests, like more theoretical tests that will also be relevant for us, because in some cases we really still don't have the power to do the experiments. So the idea is that once you have some theory you like, then you can compute its scattering amplitudes, which will directly relate to the observables in this experimental test. For example, the cross sections and so for example, our most familiar case would be in QCD. Or this is part of the standard model. And you can also go beyond standard model physics. So you just pick your favorite Lagrangian, you use it to derive Feynman rules, and then you can compute scattering amplitudes. And then cross section, you can compare with some experiments like what you observe at colliders, such as LHC, and so on. So something very important here is that the ability of really computing these amplitudes for high enough multiplicity and at beyond the leading order is really very important for compare with experiment. For example, if you want to see any new physics in the collider, you need to compute the background QCD background to very very high precision so that you can really see if there's new physics emerge from there. So this really require our ability of computing scattering amplitudes in QCD, not just to leading order or next leading order, but sometimes to next leading order, and also with high enough multiplicities. So you would say that this is not such a difficult problem because we know how to do it. As I said, you can use Feynman diagram to compute it. But in practice, this is just not really possible in most of the cases we are interested in. So one example is that if you compute some amplitudes with quarks and gluons, and the number of Feynman diagrams just grow factorially with the number of gluons. So as long as you have, say, two gluon scale, go to four gluon case, this already have hundreds of Feynman diagrams. And if you go keep going, you get thousands or even millions of Feynman diagrams in this calculation. But some very neat example that I'll present tomorrow is this so-called Park-Taylor formula that tells you that in some special helicity configuration of this tree-level process, that involve millions of Feynman diagrams in general, the answer is just one term. It's just a very compact formula for the whole amplitudes. And also, I should say that I guess you will hear a lot from David about this more this side of the story. But I will also another very important motivation is to study more formal theories, to study the amplitudes of more formal theories, which is actually a very important subject that has lots of development in the past decades. So, for example, in general, we want to understand this problem of understanding perturbative gauge theories and gravity. So we really want to have a formulation of the scattering amplitudes in gauge theories and gravity, such that we can connect to some idea and on this side, for example, some idea in quantum gravity, like also ADS-CFT, and so on. String theory, add. So these are not really any experiments, but these are some very well established. Some very very important theoretical progresses, where I think the understanding of scattering amplitudes in this setting, in this more formal theory, will provide very important theoretical data, such that you can test, say, ADS-CFT or other properties. So on this aspect, some very important theories like n equals 4 super young mu's and n equals 8 super gravity are some examples that you probably heard a lot. These are the maximally supersymmetric theories in 4D with gauge theories and gravity. So they have some very by computing there have been lots of progresses for computing their amplitudes, and by computing them there is lots of idea involved in ADS-CFT in string theory and in quantum gravity that will be probed from this calculation. So this will also be a very important motivation that I'll have in mind when I present you some formulation of this scattering amplitudes. So the idea is that both in the more phenomenological side and on the more formal side, when you compute these amplitudes, you find that the final answer is much, much simpler than this conventional way of computing them using Feynman diagrams. So I would say that there are this quite remarkable simplicities and also structures, some new structures that are obscured, completely not obvious from Feynman diagrams. So this is really, if you ask me, one of the most important motivations in studying this field, both in for theories like QCD and for theories like super young mu's and super gravity. Yeah.
So in details of doing things, are the ideas still organized as a loop expansion, or is it something else? Is it always perturbation?
Yeah. So what I'm saying here is that by doing perturbative expansion of n equals planar n equals super young mu's, you can make connection with ADS-CFT from the string size calculation. There have been lots of progress along this line. So this is really the key we want to focus, that we want to not only be able to compute amplitude, but be able to understand why they have these simplicities and these new structures. And I think just very loosely speaking, there are two kinds of reasons that I want to emphasize here that lead to this remarkable structures in amplitude. The first thing is that there's gauge redundancy in our formulation of Feynman diagrams. However, when you compute amplitude is a gauge invariant object. In other words, all this off-shell degree of freedom that involved in this Feynman diagram calculation, they all cancel in the end when you compute the final amplitude. So this is one of the reasons that the final answer is much, much simpler than your Feynman diagram calculation. So one would like to use this property that in the end you get something that's gauge invariant and only has on-shell degree of freedom, and use this to compute amplitude instead of Feynman diagram. So this is the origin of all this on-shell approach. So this leads to a lot of progress under the name of on-shell methods, say, that explores the, say, the analytic property of these amplitudes. And in this whole process, not using any off-shell degree of freedom like you used in Feynman diagrams, but directly to try to attack the final answer of this amplitude using on-shell data. For example, you will learn from this, both my lectures and David, in more detail from David, I guess, that you will have, in 4D, we can use something called spinner helicity variables. These are very powerful new variables that when amplitudes are expressed in terms of this, for example, the Park-Taylor formula I described is expressed in terms of this, it becomes very compact. And also, there are these recursions. So for example, BCFW recursion relations, some of you may heard of it, which is a recursion work at a tree level to give you all the tree amplitudes in these theories, and also some generalization for some special theory at loop level that basically only use on-shell amplitudes to build higher multiplicity amplitude. So it's a recursion. And also generalize the unitarity. This is to use the property of loop amplitudes, this unitarity property of loop amplitudes to put together tree amplitudes for obtaining this loop amplitudes. So these are one of the reasons why we see some simplicity. The second one has to do with symmetries. So this will not apply to all theories, but to some. So whenever your theory has a large amount of symmetry, it's expected that its final amplitude look very simple. However, it's not obvious from Feynman diagram because you see more degree of freedom and so on, you more redundancy, and you won't see the simplicity of here of the final answer. So, for example, there's this dual conformal symmetry. I won't go to any detail of this, but I just want to mention this, that there's dual conformal symmetry of planar n equals 4 super amus. This is a new symmetry that's completely hidden from Lagrangian or Feynman diagram point of view. You won't see this symmetry, but it exists in the final answer for your amplitude. And this is one of the reasons why you can even compute all loop amplitudes in this special theory called planar n equals 4. And there are also some new symmetries in more special theories like that. But also another example that's probably not emphasized so much is this those non-linearly realized symmetry, which will also play a role probably in my last lecture. You will see that in many, many cases, there are theories with nonlinearly realized symmetry that actually, this symmetry is also not obvious from Feynman diagram. That's why each Feynman diagram doesn't necessarily possess some property of the final amplitude. But you will see that the final amplitude being able to reflect this symmetry is one of the reasons that it's simple. For example, we all know about nonlinear Sigma model, DBI, and other theories. So these are also some theories that recently we found very nice formulation. So you could say also some effective field theory that has additional symmetry will have simple and nice scattering amplitude. Okay, so for these reasons that we know the amplitude will have simplicity and structures that's not obvious from Feynman diagram. So that's why that's the motivation for us to really looking for some dual formulations. To manifest such properties, right? So you want to have a formulation that you don't need to use Feynman diagram, but directly give you the answer like this on-shell methods, which makes the gauge redundancy go away. And also you want to have a formulation that some symmetries of the theories manifest from the beginning. So for example, some of you may heard that for this property, there's this so-called Grassmannian formulation for this special theory, as developed by Akani Hamed and friends in the past years. So this is a symmetry, this is a formulation that manifests this dual conformal symmetry and combined with the original conformal symmetry that gives you the basically the integrability of this planar n equals 4 theory. That also, I won't go into any details. But today, we'll talk about another dual formulation, which is so-called, during most of my lectures, I'll adapt to this approach, which is so-called twister string inspired approach. So this is a formulation of the of scattering amplitudes in gauge theories and gravity that will manifest lots of properties that I'll tell you. So the plan is that in these two lectures, I'll give you some basics, but also, for example, in this amplitude relation and this Riemann sphere story, I'll tell you those properties that this formulation is meant to make manifest. So this is starting from Witten's work in 2003. That he built a new topological string theory for some special theory for this, actually also for this n equals 4 super mu's. But now we've understand a lot that this generalized to very general cases, that basically this, at least at tree level, the scattering of all kinds of massless particle, their scattering amplitude can be described by some Riemann sphere based approach. So before I go to the really the actual content of today's lecture, I would like to give you a very brief review of this history of this approach. Okay, so as I mentioned, the whole story starts from this Park-Taylor formula in the 80s that they found for certain helicity of the gluons. The final answer for n gluon scattering is just one single term. So it's just after summing over millions of Feynman diagrams, you get a single term using this spinner helicity variables that you'll see tomorrow. And this formula has motivated Nair, I think also in the 80s, to write this formula as some kind of correlator on Riemann sphere. So basically, if you have a sphere that has n punctures and n points on it, you want to write some kind of correlator of a string theory on it that will give you this Park-Taylor formula. So this Riemann sphere is also known as the projective, one-dimensional projective space, CP1. And on the other side, we also know that already from the 60s, Penrose invented twister space, which is very suitable for this, for describing, so twister space of our 4D Minkowski space. So roughly, this is just space of light rays in our Minkowski space that is very suitable for describing massless particle. And you can basically call this is a space of CP3. So Witten actually used both ideas from the idea that Park-Taylor formula can be recognized as a correlator on CP1, and the idea that if you want to describe massless particle scattering, it's very nice to use this twister space, this CP3. So he actually, so this is Witten, 2003, constructed a map from the CP1 to this CP3. Yeah.
What is CP1?
Yeah, it's just projective space that, say CP1 is just this Riemann sphere that each coordinate you can give them a two-dimensional coordinate, but it's projective, so it's actually just one dimension. And CP3 is similarly, you can use four numbers to characterize a four-dimensional space with a projective property that only three of them are independent. And this won't be needed in, I mean, CP1 I'll discuss in more detail, but this won't be needed. So this is actually the motivation for Witten to write down a topological string theory. That has a world sheet on CP1, on this sphere, and then maps into this twister space of CP3. So by doing that, he's able to write down a single term formula for all the scattering amplitudes in this n equals 4 super mu theory. That's recognized as this map. But the most important thing, so something I want to emphasize is that by now we know that this construction is also very special. This is only this only works in 4D for this n equals 4 super mu theory. But now we understand that actually there's a very general construction that I will call a reformulation of very general S matrices or scattering amplitudes of massless particles. Again, based on this CP1. Or if you don't like it, you just say it's exactly just based on spheres. So the spheres plays a very, this sphere with n points on it plays a very fundamental role for this reformulation. So instead of writing amplitudes using Feynman diagonal, write them as some kind of correlator based on a sphere with n punctures. And how this new formulation is actually works in any space-time dimension. So now we have a very general framework that contains Wheaton's twister string as a special case by this line of work with together with Freddy Cacheso and Alice Nguyen in the audience. So we will have this formulation for the S matrices in any space-time dimension. So it can be with supersymmetry or without. In some space, some dimension, you can have supersymmetry. And also for very general theories, I mean, with this massless particles. For example, the most important examples we will discuss are for the gluons. So most of my talk will be about amplitudes of gluons, but also about gravitons. So once you get the amplitudes of gluons, you can get gravitons, but also we have, say, scalars, massless scalars, fermions, and say photons. Like I said, I will also discuss some, in the last lecture, I'll probably also discuss some theories like DBI and so on. So all this massless particle scattering, at the moment, I should add, is tree level. But there are some idea of how to generalize this to loop level, which hasn't been fully understood. But this is a reformulation at the moment for tree level amplitudes in any space-time dimension with very different kinds of theories. So you can describe scattering amplitudes in Young mu's, amplitudes in gravity, and in all these various effective field theories, and so on. Okay? So also very important is that it manifests properties. As I promised, this new formulation based on Riemann sphere is meant to tell you some properties of amplitudes from the beginning that is obscured from that are obscured from Feynman diagrams. For example, it will tell you about gauge invariance, about so-called soft theorem, which are basically you will hear probably in the fourth lecture or something, which is a very important universal behavior of amplitudes when some particle becomes soft, when their momentum become very small, and also amplitude relations, which will be one of the main topic today. So all these properties that you don't immediately see from Feynman diagram will become very manifest in this formulation. Okay. So let me turn to today's lecture, which is some very basic stuff about the Young mu's amplitude and so on. So the first part will be just the color decomposition of gauge theory amplitude. So basically this is a way of, and also then I'll go to the part with amplitude relation, hopefully in the end. So so-called color decomposition of gauge theory amplitudes is just a way of disentangle your color and kinematic degree of freedoms in your amplitude. So you want to find a way that you can reorganize all the color degree of freedom such that you have some, a bunch of so-called partial amplitude that only depends on the kinematics. So before I tell you about this color decomposition, let me just briefly remind you what theories we're considering. So it's a UN Yamil's theory. So Yamil's theory is a UN gauge group where you write this gauge field as n by n matrices. Okay. So I hope you're familiar with this, that you can write this into n minus, you can write this as n square generators of your UN Lie algebra with some component. So each of your gauge field carry a joint indices. And this TIs are the, these are the Lie algebra generator. So they are Hermitian traceless matrices, n by n matrices. And since you are considering a UN theory, there are all together n square of them. So the one that corresponds to I equals zero is the U1 in this UN, and the rest is the SUN. So you can also consider SUN case, but I'll do this. So now if you have this gauge field, you can plug in the, you can compute the curvature and plug in the Lagrangian, which will look like this. Where the few strings also carrying this adjoint index adjoint representation is something like this. So it's just to fix our notation. This is the coupling, and this is the structure constant of the UN algebra. So this gives you the few strings. You plug it in, you get the full Lagrangian. You can derive Feynman diagram from it. Okay. So let me just remind you how do you get this structure constant. This is just coming from the commutation relation of these generators that we saw. Normalization is fixed to be like this, and also there's a normalization condition for this. For these generators, it's just normalized like canonical data. So I hope everything is clear. These are the generators that gives you structure constant, and they're normalized like this. So you can really compute the curvature of these matrices, your gauge fields, and obtain a Lagrangian like this. Which you will. So everyone should. I hope everyone is familiar that when you plug in this, you get cubic and quartic interaction vertices, okay? So just to remind you that now we'll start to use the idea that we want to reorganize the color degree of freedom in this from the Feynman diagram here. So let me just draw it. If you have a cubic vertices with three color indices, this just is proportional to the structure constant, okay? Or if you have four, if you have this contact term, this quartic term, then you have three, FFs that's contracted. So basically you can draw it as three channel of the color. So for example, this one will be this one will have two F, like Fijm and Fklm. And similarly for this too. So this is just a way of encoding each, the color dependence of your vertices in your Feynman rules. And using this, now we want to recollect all this color dependence of your sums of the Feynman diagrams to give you the color dependence of your amplitude. Okay. So for to do that, we need some identities. For example, from this one and two, you can derive that Fijk is simply this trace of this two difference of two such traces, okay? Product of the trace of products of the generators. So in other words, since the infinite diagram, all your color dependence is given by this vertices with either F or contracted pairs of F. Now you want to rewrite this F in terms of traces. So that's how you realize that all the color dependence of your amplitudes is actually some a bunch of products of traces, okay? So the next step is that you want to express this products of traces into a single trace. So how do you do that? This is just use the completeness relation of your generators. So just bear in mind that there's this identity. So these are n by n matrices where this I and j run from 1 to n. Similarly, k and l. But if you summing over the same, summing over all the n squared generator, this simply gives you this delta I l and delta j k. Okay, this is the so-called just the completeness relation of your un generators. So use this relation. You've already expressed all the structure constant into products of traces. Now use this. You can further write them into single traces. So it's actually very good if you draw them in diagrams. So for example, if you have this Fijk, you can actually write them as difference of traces like this. So this loop means there's a trace. Trace of Ti, Tj, Tk minus trace of Ti, Tk, Tj, the commutator, okay? So once you write it like this, you can now use this completeness relation to express this products. So whenever you have two such objects, you will see a term like this. So this is the line of the trace from first one, and then the line of a trace from the second one. They are connected by a gluon propagator. And this is a Kronecker delta. Yeah.
I think you are considering ICU and not the UN because the number of generators.
Sorry, I started from zero. So the I equals zero one is the U one.
Oh.
Yeah, but if I start from one, it will be SUN.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So if I can, I'll come to this point. If I consider pure Young mus, it doesn't make a difference. It start to at tree level at least. It start to make a difference when you have fermions or if you go to loop level.
Okay.
Okay. So yes. So every point here is just a generator that carry this I, this j, and this k indices. And this loop means taking a trace of the product of them. And this direction means if you either have ti, tj, tk, or ti, tk, tj. That's
so
the two.
Right.
So basically you this is just saying that each cube, each Fijk can be written as a difference of this trace, of these two traces. And now
sorry, what does arrow mean? Like you indicated an arrow.
Yeah, this is from the product Ti, Tj, Tk.
Yeah.
And this one is like this, Ti, Tk, and Tj. So you're from this. Just from this is exactly the same as this, right? So your
arrow just means the direction between these two
take the product of the
right.
Generators. Yes, exactly. So now after you right. So after you express each cubic vertices like this, the whole color dependence of your Feynman diagram just become product of such traces. Each has three elements in it, right? So now you want to write pick any term that has a product of these traces. You want to express them as a single trace, which you will need to use the second identity. And the key is that here you have for between any two traces, it must be connected by a gluon propagator, and this gluon propagator is providing you this sum. Okay, so this completeness relation diagrammatically just means that you can write this as this. So this is basically this is I, J, K, and L. So whenever you have this is one of the generator that has I and J indices, and the other one that has K and L. Now you connect them by a gluon, meaning you're summing over this adjoint index. And the result is just a Kronecker delta of I, L, and Kronecker delta of JK. And if you're doing an SUN, very importantly, you need to move this I equals zero term to the other side. That's why you have a second term if it's SUN. So maybe I use a different color. If you are not doing UN but doing SUN, then you have a second term which is minus 1 over n delta ij and delta kl. That's coming from this generator I equals zero. Okay, so. Yes, this term will look like this. Ij. Okay. Yeah, all the others. And this is exactly the T0 generator.
So delta corresponds to one line starting and ending. I just said, like, a delta corresponds to one, the end of the initial point.
Yeah, this will be identifying these two indices. Yes. So from here you can see, right? So what we get from this step is a product of traces. Each of them has some trace like this. But now by using this identity, I basically combine these two traces into one. So that's how you combine all the product. In every term, you have product of traces, and using this continuous relation, you can easily argue that in the end, the dependence on the color when expressed in terms of traces is a single trace. Okay, so in the end, we found this color decomposition of n gluon amplitude, say in Young mu. So you start from the, so I'll use this notation that part, this label particle 1 mean you have the kinematic data, say k1, that's the momentum of this particle. And also it has, say, the polarization. It's basically the wave function of this guy. And it carries a color index as I1, okay? And particle 2 similarly carry a color index as I2 all the way to particle n. So what we just discovered is that by using this simple rearrangement of the color, all you can have is some single trace of this generator, n generators, but with any possible orderings, right? So you can obtain some permutation of your n labels. Actually, in the end, you need to sum it over all the permutations, all inequivalent permutations. That's a permutation group modular the cyclic group. And then this is all your color dependence can be written as this single trace with certain permutation. What multiplies it, the coefficient, only has kinematic dependence. And this one is what we call the partial amplitude or color ordered amplitude in Young mu's theory. So basically it inherited an ordering from this this particular trace structure that we'll write as omega 1, omega 2, to omega n. Okay? So the conclusion is that the full color dependence of your tree amplitude can be written as summing over all the cyclically inequivalent permutations. Each of them has this trace of generator. And then this part only depends on kinematics. So this is the so-called, for each trace, you have a partial or color ordered amplitudes. So altogether, you can see that you have n minus 1 factorial such partial amplitudes that only depends on the kinematics. Yeah.
This is only for gluon to gluon scattering. Right?
Yes. Yes.
And what is omega that you want?
Sorry.
Like you have omega or W. I don't know.
Yeah, this is the permutation of all your labels. So.
Can you give an example of, let's say, 3 gluons?
Right. So, for example, if you have this. Three gluons is too trivial, I guess. If you have four gluons, you have this three diagrams that I just draw there. I mean, also you have a contact diagram that you decompose into this. And then for each vertex here, you can write them as some traces, right? So each of this will be a difference of this trace minus this trace. Okay, so each of these three vertices can be written like that. Now, using this condition, since this a trace from this side and a trace from this side is connected by a gluon propagator in between, I can use this completeness relation to write them as a, so just this diagram, to write them as a single trace of four gluons. But in doing this, I have to repeat it for every finite, every color configuration. So I can get all different orderings of this color indices that I have. For example, I can have 1, 2, 3, 4. I can also have 1, 4, 2, 3. And similarly, 1, 3, 2, 4. Okay? So this is how you start from this Feynman diagram way of seeing the color dependence and translate them into this summing over different single trace color dependence. And this is only the color dependence, so each of them is accompanied by a so-called partial amplitude. So this will be your final answer, this sum of three term here will be your final answer for your four gluon scattering amplitude, which has three type of traces and I mean, actually six, but there's a reflection that I didn't really write. So this each trace will be accompanied by a partial amplitude that only depends on the kinematic. So this is the first simplification you see in dealing with color objects, right? So dealing with Young-Mills amplitude, you start with a full amplitude and all the color dependence is here, so you obtain something actually much simpler than the full amplitude, which is something we call partial amplitude. It only depends on kinematics and it has a particular ordering in it. So actually, you can directly write down Feynman rules for this color ordered amplitude, the so-called color order Feynman rules that can be used to compute them. And since they have this ordering, they are much simpler than the full amplitude. Say, for example, they only have propagators that respect this ordering. They cannot have arbitrary propagators and so on. Okay? Yeah.
So if we did not have a single trace, could we not have done this? Like, why is a single trace structure important?
It's simply a fact that when you collect all the color factor, you see a single trace. So if you go to one loop, you'll start to see single trace and double trace structure and so on. Yeah. So
these are megas, they really represent some choice of ki or epsilon I for that particular problem, like outgoing external book.
They are all the same data, but with a different ordering now. Because you organize your full amplitude into different orderings of the colors. And these are the so-called color ordered amplitude that depends on this order. But this one is still this, has this kinematic data, K1, epsilon 1, this 2 is still that. But they have a different ordering in each term. So in order to know the full amplitude, now the task is to compute this n minus 1 factorial partial amplitudes that you can use, say, color ordered Feynman rule to compute it, which is much simpler. That's the simplification here. Yeah. One, four, oh, sorry. Did I write it wrong? Sorry, I should write this one as. So all, in that language, altogether, there are actually six of them because it's n minus one factorial, but there are reflections. So for example, I should have written this as 1, 4. So this one is 1, 3, 2, 4 is actually equivalent to 1, 4, 2, 3 because the trace has a reflection. So this one should actually be 1, 4, 3, 2. Sorry, I didn't really, I wasn't being very careful here. Yeah. So these are the three distinct trace structure you can have, including the reflection symmetry. So there are some, as I said, this guy, each of them is gauge invariant, and also they have some property like they are cyclic and reflection up to a sign. But there's also a very important property that these are not all independent. So there are some further simplification you can see that you don't need to actually compute all the n minus one factorial of them, but there are some so-called amplitude relation among this partial amplitude. So this is what I mean here by amplitude relation. The simplest case is this so-called U1 decoupling identity that I will tell you now. of this amplitude. So basically, if you write down this partial amplitude with an ordering like that, you start to move one particle. And you're summing over all such, all possibility of moving particle one, for example. So particle one is here. This is the canonical ordering, 1, 2, 3, up to n. You jump particle one to this place, and you can further jump it here. All such term in the end, you can jump particle one to the last one position, because if you jump further, it becomes the first one by cyclicity, right? This whole sum is zero. This is the content of this so-called U1 decoupling identity. So it tells you that not all these partial amplitudes are independent. There are some relation among them. This is the simplest one. So how do you see this physically? It's very, very simple. It's basically from the beginning that I have a UN group that has this particular guy U1. It's commuting with the remaining SUN. So actually, you have this structure constant F0ij, where ij goes from 1 to n squared equals 1. These are always 0, OK? This structure constant with a 0 in it. Physically means something very simple. If you consider a UN gauge group with this U1 being, say, a photon in it, this photon and the gluon never have interaction vertices. So that this structure constant is 0 means that they never interact with each other. And this is exactly the coefficient that you can extract. Say, if you set Ti1 equals the U1 generator, so I1 is 0. If you set this to be the identity, the U1 generator, you plug it in, you find that this is the coefficient of that of the generator of, say, of the trace of Ti2 to Tin. So I can leave this as an exercise that start from this color decomposition. One can prove that the coefficient, by setting Ti1 to identity, the coefficient of this is exactly this combination. And since we know the amplitude must vanish, because photon with the rest of gluon have vanishing amplitude, so this must be 0. Okay, so this is the first indication that there are relations among them. And there are actually more relations that I'll tell you now. There are more relations than this. Okay, let me first tell you this. So this is only one of the U1 decoupling identities. There are more than one, right? So you can also set, say, Ti2 equals 0. Ti2 being the U1 generator, you can get that. And altogether, there's this so-called Kleist-Coif relations or identities that allows you to reduce this number n minus 1 factorial to n minus 2 factorial. So it's basically saying among all these partial amplitudes, only n minus 2 factorial of them are independent. And this relations are nothing but repeated use of this U1 identity. So if you keep using it, saying here you keep moving I2, you will reach this Kleist-Coif relation that tells you that any partial amplitude of the ordering 1, alpha, n, and beta. So alpha and beta denotes the some ordering of the remaining guys into this two sets. This can be expressed as a linear combination of only amplitude with 1 and n in the end, and some permutation omega here. So I won't give you the precise formula, but here is the minus of the number of beta. Omega is actually given by the shuffle of alpha and the reverse of beta. So basically, if you have two deck of cards, you shuffle them, you keep their relative ordering, but mix them together. This is the formula you want to have. So starting from this U1 decoupling, you can actually keep using it, you can actually reduce the number of independent partial amplitudes to this number, which you can basically fix two guys. So this is known for many decades. And for until 2008, people thought this is the minimal basis of your partial amplitudes you can have. But then, yes.
So what exactly do you mean by amplitude when you're only now three?
Sorry?
So the M1 omega n.
Yes. Okay, so omega is, let me write it complete. Omega is a permutation of the remaining labels, omega 2, omega 3 to omega n minus 1, and then n. This alpha and beta are any orderings of some of the remaining particle 2 to n in two sets.
If we have the example of 4, then it's then omega.
Yeah, for example, for 4 particle, this relation is exactly equivalent to this because you have m 1, 2, 3, 4 plus m 2, 1, 3, 4 plus m 2, 3, 1, 4 equals 0. So you can actually use this, you can actually express everything in terms of 2m with 1, 4 fixing in two sides. Yes. So the point I want to make here, yes. Yes, it's actually just a it's not obvious from this form, but it's actually keep. So how should I say? So one way to prove this identity is you can consider more and more U1 in your theory rather than just one single photon, and asking all those amplitude to vanish, you can derive this. But there's a different way of deriving it, which is using the color kinematics. I mean, basically the anti-symmetry of the color of your structure constant, you can also prove this. Yeah, so this is just a very simple relation of this amplitude without talking to the kinematics. Only the color part tells you that there's this relation. But
so alpha and beta are some sequence
of remaining photons. Not photons. Sorry, just these are all gluons, right? These are Yamil's amplitude. Yeah.
And then what is absolute value of beta?
Oh, this is the number of beta, number of particles in beta. Yeah. See. Yeah, I wanted to just emphasize that you can reduce to this number, but this is still at a level that you're only manipulating all the color factors here. Yes.
So, sorry, how does this work in the case of 4 particles?
Okay.
You're saying you could reduce to n minus 2 factor,
right? Yes. So two of them.
Right, so only two, but it seems as though there's three in the example. I guess one is on the other side, so there's three in total of them.
Yeah, yeah. So basically this is saying that you can express let me see. Oh yeah. For example, this one. You can actually write them as m 1, 3, 2, 4 by reflection, right? 1, 3, 2, 4. So this expression is saying that this guy, which is of the form, this guy you can also write m 1, 3, 4, 2. So 3 is your alpha, 2 is your beta. This guy's the minus this minus 1, 2, 3, 4. So basically, it's saying that you can express something that's not in this standard form of 1, 4 sitting on two sides in terms of n minus 2 factorial guys as the basis that's always in this form. Okay. So you can do it for n particle always. But something much more surprising is worked about by Bern, Rasko, and Johansson in 2008, this so-called BCG relations. And this will play a role, important role in our discussion tomorrow, that we'll see that both this U1 decoupling and this BCG relation, I mean, more generally, this Kleist-Koyff relation and this BCG relation tells us that we want to have a Riemann sphere to describe this partial amplitudes. But let me just tell you what is this relation. This relation tells you that you can further reduce the independent number of partial amplitudes from n minus 2 factorial to n minus 3 factorial. So the origin of this, I won't go to the detail of the origin of this relation. There are just the coming from the so-called color kinematic duality. And the consequence of them is that you can further reduce amplitudes already in a KK basis, in this Kleist-Koyff basis, to even a smaller basis. And this is so-called the minimal basis of your gauge theory amplitudes. So these are generally very complicated relations involving kinematic invariants. But now I will write down something called fundamental BCG relations, which can generate all BCG relation for you to go to this minimal basis. But this one is enough. So before I do that, I just want to remind you that in our discussion, we have this massless particle forming there. We have this, we have the momentum of n massless particles, k1 mu, k2 mu, kn mu. So they satisfy momentum conservation, and we assume all the particles are outgoing, so we have the sum of them equals zero. And also we have ki squared equals zero, that's the massless condition. Okay, so from here you can construct all the Lorentz, all the Mandelstam variables, or Lorentz invariant of this momenta. So basically, you can have the Mandelstam variable Sij as defined as ki plus kj squared, and in the massless case, it's simply 2 times ki dot kj. Okay, and we have a bunch of properties such, for example, Sii is zero. And also summing over j of Sij is also zero. So this is a consequence of massless condition, and this is the momentum conservation. So this is just our kinematic setting that our amplitudes will depend on this and also other variables like polarization and so on. So fundamental BCG relation will be expressed as a relation among these partial amplitudes that the coefficient is no longer just 1 or minus 1. The coefficient will depends on this kinematic data, okay? So these are some universal relation of the amplitude. And they look actually very, very similar to this U1 identity, U1 decoupling identity. That's why I want to emphasize this U1 decoupling. So the only thing that changes is you put some Mandelstam in front of each particle. So say the first one, I put an S11, and everyone knows that there are this S11 is zero, so this term is actually not there. Okay, this is zero. The second one is the first term S12 that I want to put in this term. Okay. And then the third term is actually a sum of two, S12 plus S13, that you put in front of this guy. two, three, one, four to n, and all the way to the last term, which is S12, S13 to S1n-1, multiplied by 2, 3, 4, n-1, 1, n. So this whole sum should be zero. This is the so-called fundamental BCG relations. So you can see that this is very similar to the U1 decoupling identity, but each term is just with the sum of this Mandelstam S1 something with the particle in front of it. You can also put the sum of the Mandelstam with particle after the one because of momentum conservation that I give here, right? So for example, the last term where you have the sum of S12, S13 all the way to S1n-1. This is nothing but the minus S1n, this last term, right? Just by momentum conservation. So this is the relation that tells you further that there are even relations among this KK basis that depends on the Mandelstam. So there are actually, if you repeatedly using this, just as you repeatedly using U1, you can reduce to n-2 factorial. This allows you to reduce to a minimal basis of n-3 factorial partial amplitudes. Yes?
You wrote n plus 1 at the end there inside the amplitude. What is n plus 1?
Sorry, n minus 1. That's it. I should write it bigger. Yes. So this is the identity that I want you to have an idea, and we'll show this tomorrow for the Park-Taylor formula, and also tells you why this implies a Riemann sphere. Yes.
Is this now a proof that there's a minimal, that this is a minimal basis, or could there be possibly
more? Yeah, there's a proof that this is a minimal basis. Yeah.
Could we actually write that down for a case of four particles?
Sure. Yeah. So I started from this one. This is the where's the eraser? Couldn't find this. Sorry. Okay. So as I told you, four particle, there's this U1 decoupling identity that tells you you can reduce them to reduce the three independent guy to two, okay, using this to the KK basis. Now you can do further. You can put S11 in front of the first one and S12 in front of the second one. And then S12 plus S13 in front of the third one. And the claim is that this combination is also zero. So now you can, this one actually doesn't, is not there. I'm just writing it because it's more symmetric. S11 is zero, right? So this is actually a relation between the remaining two guys. So they're actually proportional to each other with a factor of this Mandelstam in it. So in four-point case, we also use some Mandelstam. I hope you have at least seen it before. So for example, we write S12 and S34, they are the same. By momentum conservation, we call them S. S14 and S23, call them T. S13 and S24, we call them U. So this relation, and also by momentum conservation, S plus T plus U is zero, okay? For the massless case. So this relation is actually telling you, in the four-point case, it's telling you that S times this M2134, for example, is actually equal to T times this M2314. So they're proportional to each other, this four-point partial amplitudes for four gluons. Where this T is just this combination is S plus U is minus T, right? So this is the four-point BCJ relation, tells you that all the partial amplitudes are proportional to each other with some Mandelstam as the coefficient. So in the last 10 minutes, I actually wanted to give you a toy model of this all these relations, but now with scalars. So this will also play a very important role in our constructions of the third lecture and later, that this so-called bi-adjoint scalar theory will be also a basic building block of this new formulation we have and tells you how to relate them to gravity. So, and in that theory, you will see explicit examples that you can compute from Feynman diagram because they are scalar theories. There's nothing mysterious about it. That you can see this U1 decoupling and the BCG relations. Okay, before I proceed, is there any more questions? Okay, so let me just introduce you this this toy model for, at least for the color. Actually, it's a perfect toy model for all the color dependence of your gluons. So-called bi-adjoint scalar theory. It's nothing mysterious but a phi cube theory. However, it's a fancy phi cube theory you will see immediately. So you all know the phi cube theory without mass is something like this. Space. Right? This is the Lagrangian for the phi cube theory, massless phi cube theory. And now I want to put some color to this or flavor to this scalars. I don't want to just have a single scalar, but I want to put some color. So just as I did to the young muse, I said this gauge field is given by this with some color indices. I can do the same for the scalars. However, if you do this, so this is the most natural thing to do, right? You put a Fijk for this phi cube, that each of them carry a joint index, you get zero, right? Is this clear? Every cubic vertices becomes zero because this is symmetric in the three of them by Bose symmetry, and this is anti-symmetric. So the simplest thing you can do to make a phi cube theory to carry color or flavor is to make it bi-adjoint. So you want these scalars to be colored or flavored not under just a group of un, but under un cross un tilde, for example. So what you really want to do is to put the bi-adjoint indices, so two such indices for each scalar, one I from un and I tilde from un tilde, and put two structure constants here. So this will be an f of I tilde, j tilde, k tilde. So this is the theory we want to consider. And it turns out it's a very interesting theory that has many applications in this whole construction. So for example, what's the Feynman diagram of this theory? It's very simple, right? So the amplitude of this theory is just summing over all the, say, tree level. We're considering tree level. It has this coupling dependence lambda to the n minus 2 power. It's just summing over all the cubic tree diagrams, meaning that the Feynman diagram is cubic internal vertices only. And it's simply you put propagators of each diagram, and you put color factors here, right? So if it's a really a phi cube, then each vertices is just one. But now the vertices are given by the structure constant. That's all. So that's what I mean by color factor. So for each cubic vertices of the scalar theory, you have ii tilde, you have jj tilde, and kk tilde. In Feynman diagram, we just write it literally as fijk, fi tilde, j tilde, k tilde. So for a given cubic diagram, you collect all such color factors. You take the product of them, and you call this the color factor of your theory. So it's nothing but given by just summing over all cubic diagram with color factors. Okay. So let me give you an example. For 4-point, what is the Feynman diagram in this theory? It's simply this diagram with S channel in it, T channel, and U channel, okay? And what is this C and C tilde? They are the color factor, as I told you. So this is the S channel scattering, 1, 2, 3, 4. This is T channel, 1, 4, 2, 3. And the last one is the U channel. So the color factor for each of them is just the following. So CS is just given by F I1, I2, J, and I3, I4, J, where J is contracted, right? This is the CS as given by the Feynman rule. Similarly for CT, and CU. Is that clear? And also there are the part for the tildes. Just replace it by the tildes. So this is the final, this is the full amplitude of this guy. That's why I discussed this theory instead of the Young Muse, because it's so simple. But it has all these properties about the color decomposition, U1 and BCJ in this theory. Okay? So first let's see what's the color decomposition of this. Let me write it here, maybe. Instead of Young Muse, let's do the color decomposition of that theory. Everything is the same, if not simpler, because it doesn't have aquatic vertices that you need to decompose into three type of only cubic vertices contractions. So you can again write all this F structure constant in terms of difference of traces, and then the product of traces will be written in terms of using a completeness relation to be written in terms of a single trace. So in the end, the decomposition is that this is for the phi cube theory. You can decompose them in terms of colors in the first the un, and have this t I of omega 1 all the way to I of omega n of this partial amplitudes that depends on a ordering of the first color omega 1 omega 2 to omega n. Okay. This is one decomposition you can do. You can also do it with the second one, right? Everything is the same except now it's the tilde ones. I tilde of omega 1. And we'll call this M tilde. this is our partial amplitude. They're actually the same thing. It's just there. Or you can actually do it. You can so when you decompose it in terms of the first the un, this guy still depends on all the color of the second group, un tilde, right? So now you can start to decompose this guy in terms of un tilde. So in the end, you can actually do a double decomposition of the color. So in terms of both un, un tilde decompositions. So in the end, you write down something that's very suggestive. That has an omega and a rho trace of ti omega 1 to ti omega n, and then trace of ti tilde rho 1 to ti tilde rho n. And then we call this amplitude small m of omega and rho. So it's actually, this is something we call double partial amplitudes of this bi-adjoint scalar theory. Okay? So you can not only do color decomposition in one of the two gauge group, but you can actually do it for both. And in the end, this is the guy that's really the partial amplitude because it only depends on kinematics. All your color information is singled out in this double sum of permutations. Okay?
In that, why don't we get cross terms like CS, CT tilde, and things like that?
Because these are all the Feynman diagram you can draw. And for each vertices, it has, so for the first vertex, it has a F12J and an F tilde 12J. The second one has 3, 4J. So there's never a cross term. So this, the key is that you have a single type of cubic vertices as a product of the two. Yeah. Yes.
I thought one of the motivations here was to avoid Feynman diagrams, but in the end, you're using them anyways.
Right, sure. For scalars, it doesn't make sense to switch to anything else. It's just doing Feynman diagrams is good enough. But you'll see that for Yamuse and even especially for gravity, it's impossible to do that. So, but this is just a motivation of studying this general relations among partial amplitudes. So I'll use the scalar as an example. Just the last thing I want to say is that all these guys satisfy the U1 and the BCG relation that I sketched. Yeah. Yes. Yes. It depends on both permutations. So this omega is just omega 1, omega 2 to omega n. Yes, it's like a matrix. It's like, yeah, depends on two indices. So you can view this Yamuse partial amplitudes as a vector and this as a matrix. This will play a role later. But I just want to give you an exercise to prove the following, to prove U1. Okay, let me write it down. Prove U1 decoupling and fundamental BCG relation for 4 point. For this M4, for example. So you can actually do this partial amplitude with any of this M or M tilde, or even with this guy if you fix one of the permutation, right? So what I want you to prove more precisely is this one. So just as you did for, just as what I write down for Yamuse, that you have this two type of relation, but here it's very complicated to write them, to compute this amplitude in terms of Feynman diagram. It's very easy, as I already give you the example, that the full amplitude is written like this. So now if you do the color decomposition of them into this partial amplitude like this, you will use the following. So for U1 decoupling, it turns out you need to use the antisymmetry of your Fijk. And for BCG relation, you need to use the Jacobi identity of this. So just to remind you, what is the Jacobi identity here for the 4-point case? It's simply CS minus CT equals CU. Okay, this is the Jacobi identity of your Lie algebra. Each C is the product of 2F with indices conjective. So this will be left as an exercise to show that this works. I guess I have to stop now. So tomorrow I'll continue with this, but now for young mules, I will show you in a special case of this. I'll first introduce spinner helicity and the Park-Taylor formulas, and I will show you how they satisfy this U1 and the BCG relation, which motivate us to write down something we call scattering equation based on a Riemann sphere. Okay.
Right. So are there any questions?
Yes.
So the initial discussion about party composition, isn't that the greatest thing about crossing symmetry of these diagrams? And it's just saying that since each of the diagrams are actually, well, essentially, I guess maybe you'd expect there to be other factors associated with the different diagrams. But the fact that there's exactly the same prefactor for every single diagram except for color, isn't that a consequence of crossing symmetry? Or that the statement of crossing symmetry?
It definitely implies that. For example, your final, when you decompose it this way, your partial amplitudes are cyclic invariant, and then you're summing over all cyclic inequivalent permutations. That's why it's permutation invariant. But I think it's more than that. For example, if you do, this is strongly depend on you are doing tree level, right? As I showed you, all the diagram I draw is tree diagrams, such that you can do this decomposition into a final single trace diagram. If you're doing a one loop amplitude, it won't work like this, the color decomposition. Right? You start to have other structures, not just single trace. Yeah. So it's more than just the.
But I guess even starting from here, I would have expected, even after doing all these little games of playing with your traces,
mm-hmm.
I would have mainly expected, if I didn't know anything about quantum field theory, that there would be extra factors on the, like, for different directions of these diagrams. But that's simply not the case, right? They all, if they look at, say, M4, there's no extra factors except the colors. So that's not obvious ahead of time, but it's a consequence of quantum field theory. Is that correct? So.
Sorry, in the... You mean in this case?
If I naively try to calculate something in this theory, I would have expected to have different factors for different directions these diagrams.
But that's
simply not the case. And I guess I'm trying to understand whether that's because of cross-symmetry.
Well, I think it's more than that. It depends on the fact that you can decompose all your diagrams into these cubic vertices. That depends on. That has a structure constant associated with it. And then you're at tree level. So it's basically the statement that a tree diagram with only cubic vertices, each associated with an Fijk, can be written as a single trace, summing over single traces. I think that's the more precise statement. So if you change either the condition of this color dependence of your vertices or the condition of tree, you know, if you go to loops, then it's no longer true.
Would it be correct to say that this permutation symmetry for M particles reduces to crossing symmetry for 4? Just to build those statements together.
I don't understand why you make this statement. Reducing to permutation of 4 particles?
In the case of 4 particles.
Oh, yes.
That's all I'm asking. But in general, it's much more general than that.
Yeah, sure. So this here you see that as a summing over this three diagram is manifestly crossing symmetric, but in
Can this be general to other groups like the O-N
group? Yeah, so should I say it? So there's actually another color decomposition, not in terms of the traces of this generator, but rather in terms of the structure constant. That definitely works for also the groups you mentioned. Yes. I mean, here I'm stick to UN and I use this trace basis.
Yes. So there is a similar simplification happening
for other gauge groups. Yes. Yes.
Any other last questions?
So everywhere we have this SN taking out the ZN.
ZN, yeah.
So that's a consequence six of the trace being cyclical?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Okay, so that's thanks, Song, again.
Thank you.